This is HPC Wire Soundbite, your weekly source of commentary and insight on the HPC stories shaping the industry. With Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360 Research. And now, here are your hosts, Michael Feldman and Addison Snell.
Hello, everyone, and good morning for HPC Wire Soundbite for August 28, 2009, available every Friday on iTunes. I'm Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and we have with us Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360. Good morning once again, Addison.
Good morning, Michael.
Well, we had some interesting news break late this week about Cycortex, the defunct HPC cluster vendor. We're also going to review some of the latest high-end server chip from IBM, Sun, and AMD and others that were being talked up at the Hot Chips conference this week at Stanford University. But first, we're going to hit the Cycortex news. Apparently, Cray has acquired some of the Pascal compiler assets from Cycortex, which went out of business earlier this year due to the lack of VC funding. Pascal represents one of just a handful of compiler technologies that are designed for high-performance computing, so it's a really valuable asset to the community. And when Cycortex went under, there was quite a bit of concern about the fate of the compiler technology. Just a little history, the Pascal compiler had been acquired by Cycortex back in 2007, I think in August, from QLogic, which had originally bought Pascal the year before in 2006. Now, the current deal with Cray looks like it involves the resurrection of a new Pascal company and the involvement of an open source group, netsynchro.com. In truth, it was all a little confusing to me, but we're fortunate to have with us today on the show Christopher Bergstrom, who will be Pascal's new chief technology officer. Sir, I'm hoping will help us unravel this all a bit. So welcome to HPC Wire Soundbite, Christopher.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we should probably start out with your role in all this. Briefly, tell us a little bit about your background in regard to Pascal compiler technology, and then how did the Cray deal come about?
It was started about a year ago. I was working on building a high-performance HPC platform that was Open Solaris technology-based, and we needed a compiler for it, but unfortunately the only thing available was GCC and Sun Studio. And with my strong background in open source, you know, I definitely wanted to, you know, go with open source technology and leverage that as much as possible. So with, you know, the Sun Studio stuff being, you know, just rumors, I started working with the Pascal engineers and for their sister project, Open64, over to Open Solaris. And, you know, that went really well. But one of the things that I realized, though, that, you know, it's not just a matter of porting an open source compiler, but, you know, having a community behind it. So, you know, I started working with more of the engineers from HP, NVIDIA, even some people over at Google, and I really started to get a feel for more of the community. And when I did, I thought, you know, it'd be interesting if I'm able to integrate into my platform, you know, this high-performance compiler. So, you know, that's where the relationship with Pascal originally started, but, you know, because they were still part of Cycortex, you know, their focus was heavily on MIPS and not necessarily x86 or, you know, even community building at that point. You know, they just had a very finite focus. Then, you know, after the Cycortex announced that they were actually going to be auctioning off all of the Pascal assets, you know, I got together with some open source advocates from Linux Fund, and we did a quick 48-hour fundraiser to actually try and make a vibe for the assets to get them all put public, and that was unfortunately unsuccessful. You know, it took a lot of money to actually purchase the assets, and we weren't successful. Some of the information about who actually acquired the assets was leaked to me through various means, and that's when I started a discussion with Cray. And, you know, after a few months of trying to work out the technical and the business deals of it, you know, I'm really, really quite ecstatic with, you know, the end results.
So from the Cray press release, it sounds like a new Pascal company will actually be resurrected in some form. Could you explain Cray's relationship in regard to the organization now, and also how the open source group netsynchro.com fits into this?
Yeah, there is going to be a new Pascal company. The relationship there is that Cray acquired all of the assets, and they're planning to use some of the technology, you know, where it makes sense for them. But at the same time, you know, they wanted to make sure that they had a good steward for the code base, someone who was taking, you know, a leadership role, building a community behind it, and, you know, really the driving force behind Pascal. So, you know, that's where we stepped in. We said, you know, we have a strong open source community. We think we can really provide a lot of direction, but at the same time, we also think that we can push it as a business because, you know, our core focus on the back end side of things has been high performance. So, you know, pushing, you know, a compiler in there with, you know, some of our other products just makes natural sense.
Christopher, PathScale is obviously a technology group, whether it was on its own or within another company, that we've been following for a long time, and compilers are getting to where they're an extremely valuable and critical part of the solution set, especially with a lot of the transition going on with various new technologies at new inflection points or increasing adoption. For example, PathScale has always been Linux-based and open source, but Cray, who you've got this close relationship with, also supports Windows on the CX-1. Any plans for Windows-based compilers?
I have to be honest that on a personal level, I'm not a big Windows fan. I use open source exclusively, you know, for everything that I do. But I will say that, you know, our relationship with Cray is one that's good enough that, you know, if they said, hey, you know, we need a Windows port, that, you know, it might be something on our roadmap, even though, you know, I personally would object to it.
Well, what about the path ahead with multi-core and many-core? You know, Michael's covered the Hot Chips conference right now, and that's actually probably the biggest adjustment that users have to get used to out there. What kind of developments do you have in the PathScale compiler set to help people optimize for multiple cores?
Well, I think there's going to be three sides to this. One, there's we have some Skunkworks research going on currently where some of the people who are leading the research in these areas, we're trying to recruit them, we're working with them. But at the same time, we're also building some development tools that will help us identify where the bottlenecks are and, you know, figuring out those different issues. So, you know, when we get feedback from customers on the specific benchmarks, we'll do what we always do, you know, just tune and just make better performance.
Christopher, thanks very much for joining us. Everybody, we've been joined by Christopher Bergstrom today, CTO of PathScale. Christopher, thanks very much for your time today.
It was great being here. And, you know, just one last quick thanks to Cray. So those guys are great over there. And you have a nice day.
All right. Thanks a lot, Christopher. We appreciate your time. Well, Michael, we had that excellent conversation with Christopher with regards to the PathScale compilers, and it's actually an excellent transition point to our other story from today with Hot Chips, because we've got to be looking ahead to what are the effects of multiple cores in the industry and how users are going to be responding to that. But let's start by talking about your coverage of this event. You were really following it all along, and what were some of your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I was following it sort of curiously because I couldn't attend the conference itself, which was at Stanford University. But there was a lot of coverage of it because these, what was talked about, were the next generation of high-performance, high-end server chips that are going to be out there over the next year or two. So there was a lot of excitement around IBM's Power 7 chip, which has been talked about for, it seems like, years now and is now on the cusp of being introduced, still sometime in 2010. But they talked a little bit about the details of what that was like. And they also, Sun Microsystems talked about Rainbow Falls, their 16-core Spark chip, and then AMD talked a little bit about their 12-core Magna cores. And there were some other vendors also talking about some of their chips. But the biggest story really was the Power 7, simply because it looks like that might be sort of the chip to beat, if you will, in the high-end server space. That's the one, of course, that's going to go into the Blue Waters, the 10 petaflop system that is going to deployed at NCSA sometime around 2011. Of course, the Power 7 chips are also going to go into the commercial IBM Power machines, so there's a lot of interest throughout the industry on that. But it's an interesting chip. It's an 8-core chip. It's the 45-nanometer technology. They've got this cool little embedded eDRAM that implements the L3 cache that was used on the IBM BlueJean ASIC, and now it's going to be incorporated into the Power 7 line. So it's quite an interesting little chip, and I have a feeling it's probably going to be the highest performing CPU out there, with maybe the exception of the one from Fujitsu, the Spark chip that they just came out with recently, that was also, I think, talked about a little bit at the conference, but not very much.
Michael, I'm going to ask a question that's kind of right on the top of my mind here. I read your blog, and I'm listening to you talk about it, and you said, well, there's IBM, and there's Sun, and there was AMD, and then there were some other vendors, and Intel really is not coming out here in terms of who's putting out the hot chips. Yet we look at it, and Intel's been really dominant in the HPC space recently. So, you know, kind of what's the deal here? Is when you're talking about all the excitement, is it really that Intel didn't have as much to say, or you weren't surprised by Intel? Because it seems to me like IBM and Sun and AMD are showing up to training camp fighting over who's going to get to be the backup quarterback, right? Isn't Intel going to be in the lead?
Oh, well, yeah, Intel's going to be in there. I don't know the lead, who knows. But, I mean, Intel has got its Mahalem EX coming out. But they've already talked about that quite a bit in the run-up to this conference. I think they even talked about it at the conference. They talked about Mahalem EX and the Westmere 32-nanometer technology. It wasn't picked up in the press to the extent some of these other things were, because these other chips we know a little bit less about, so they're sort of newer and a little bit more exciting. So the Mahalem EX is sort of old news, but certainly they're positioning, Intel's positioning that chip to go right up against, you know, the RISC chips in these high-end server machines. So there's a real battle now. The x86 chips are vying against the RISC chips at the high end, and so with all these chips coming in with, you know, 8 cores and above, it's going to be interesting. I mean, now we're getting to double-digit core counts, so it's quite an interesting development now, and also a diversity of core counts. So it's not, you know, some have 8 cores, some have 12 cores. The Sun Rainbow Falls chip that was talked about has 16 cores. The Power 7 chip itself comes, I think, in 3 variants, 4, 6, and 8. And I have a film, the one that's going into the Blue Water supercomputer is going to be an 8-core version. But, yeah, Intel is going to be in there. It's just they didn't quite capture the press imagination at this particular conference because it's kind of old news. But, again, that chip's going to be released in 2010 along with these other chips. So it's going to be an interesting showdown in 2010 as all these really multi-core, almost bordering on many-core chips start to enter into mainstream high-end servers.
Well, and I think that's going to be the critical thing to watch in HPC, Michael. I mean, we've been tracking in our research the adoption, or rather the very slow, or in some cases lack of adoption, of even dual core and quad core, where people finally now are starting to upgrade their single core systems, and you're forced to put in at least a dual core chip. But what we found is that the adoption of multiple cores in HPC has been slow, and that as they are getting adopted, users are compensating by just increasing the amount of memory in the system, and keeping memory per core is a constant. So if I double the number of cores, I'm going to double the amount of memory, with the straightforward implication being that as often as possible, users are assigning individual jobs to individual cores, which means really that you're not taking advantage of any sort of parallelism between multiple cores yet. There's a lot of optimization out there still waiting to happen that users to this day haven't been fully confronted with, and I think that goes back to what we were just talking to Christopher about with the path scale compilers. I mean, was there any discussion at Hotchips, as far as you could tell, about how are we going to actually get any kind of efficiency out of all these cores?
Well, since I sort of covered all this secondhand, I'm not sure, but I think it was mainly the hardware vendors talking this up. So I have a feeling there was probably less about the software side, which of course, as you mentioned, is a critical component. How are we going to deal with these core counts as they start to bump into the double digit range, and then the diversity of counts? So you can't. I mean, I think this at least sends a signal, if nothing else, to the software vendors and tool makers that they're going to have to deal with, you know, this multi-core model, other than hard-coding something for dual cores or quad cores, if they're going to have a chance of taking advantage of the power of these chips. I mean, one thing they did talk about at the conference quite a bit was sort of the cache and memory subsystems that are being hooked up with these CPUs. It's becoming more and more important as you keep increasing the core counts to keep feeding these chips with data. Otherwise, it's all for naught. So there's quite a bit of innovation around the cache. I mean, bigger caches. Everybody's going to be on DDR3 memory now, which is a faster memory system, and then bigger memories, like you mentioned. So there's more and more emphasis on the memory subsystem and even the interconnects, the I/O interconnects beyond that. So I think that was talked about quite a bit. It'll be interesting to see the different approaches. For instance, the Rainbow Falls chip from Sun, I don't think even had an L3 cache. They have something called a coherency unit and a different arrangement there. So I think people are sort of experimenting with how to kind of feed all these cores, but the software guys are going to be left having to do the sort of the heavy lifting to make it all work. And, you know, I think that's going to be the challenge in the next decade, starting with 2010, on how to make this all work, how to take advantage of all these. I mean, the hardware guys, this is their idea. This is the way they're going to do it. So it's up to the software guys to make it work.
Yep. I that's exactly the point, I think. think, is the memory systems are a necessary but insufficient condition on their own. Obviously, you're going to need bigger, faster memories to keep these cores fed, but fundamentally, we're dealing with a new level of parallelism on the socket and addressing fundamental questions like, is the current MPI adequate for this type of parallelism? And these are, to me, open questions. We've dealt with some people already who are right at the crux of this problem, like last week with our conversation with RapidMind or Caps Enterprise in France or those sorts of companies who are really dealing with addressing that part of the middleware layer. I think there's a part of this conversation that's also going to come back around to Microsoft again and whether they're able to embed functionality into Windows that will automatically, dynamically assign jobs to multiple cores and potentially give Windows a leg up on scalability. So I certainly wouldn't count out that possibility. So I guess what I'm saying is I appreciate the coverage of hot chips, and it's exciting to look at the raw potential power in all of these processors going forward. But there's a big part of me as an analyst that's kind of shaking my head wondering who's going to come up with the magic sauce that lets us use it.
Yeah, I wonder the same thing. I think what also it plays into is, you know, to what extent sort of these more exotic, if mainstream RISC chips are going to have a role in the next generation of supercomputers. I mean, the Power 7 chip is obviously going to be in these specialty machines like Blue Waters, but since x86 chips have come on so strong, it just seems like they're the ones that are going to dominate most of multi-core supercomputing. I think most of the software tools are going to be written around that architecture. Now, of course, you know, we just talked to Pascal people, and they have multi-targeted technology, so we might see some diversity, but I think the lion's share of the support is going to be around x86, and I think, you know, things like Power 7 and certainly Rainbow Falls, which is a Spark chip, is going to be relegated sort of a minor role in these high-end servers.
Well, talk to me for a second about Rainbow Falls and this Spark chip, because that could turn into even less than a minor role, right? What are the chances that that never even sees the light of day with the Oracle Sun merger still pending?
Well, yeah, that's what everybody's talking about. I mean, yeah, it was sort of amazing to see them actually come out and even give that talk, since the Oracle Sun deal is still up in the air, and, you know, it's still quite uncertain if Oracle is going to pick up the Sun chip business or even the Sun hardware business overall.
And so we should give a quick update on where we stand with that, right? Last week, that deal got U.S. regulatory approval, but is still awaiting European Union regulatory approval, which is expected, which is expected within the next couple of weeks, probably in the first half of September, and which isn't a slam dunk because anecdotally, historically, the European Union has a tendency to be more strict on these than even the U.S. regulatory compliance. So it's not even 100% certain yet that the deal will go through. I think it's probable. If it does go through, I don't know how certain it is that we're going to see Oracle keeping these hardware lines going forward. In fact, I think it's unlikely, and the big question is whether or not this gets sold to somebody who's going to pick it up.
Right. I mean, it might be, you know, this would be something maybe Fujitsu would pick up. They've got sort of another high-end Spark chip that's more oriented towards the high-performance computing market. The Rainbow Falls chip is really, from what I understand, is not really oriented towards technical computing. Its floating point is not as strong. I mean, the ROC chip that Sun kind of pulled the plug on last year or recently was probably the only one that had the chance of making it to a supercomputer. But that one, you know, they haven't talked about in months, and reports are that, you know, that's no longer a going concern. So Rainbow Falls maybe, but like I said, it might go by the wayside or be bought up by another vendor. We'll just have to see. And yeah, I mean, we'll see if the merger goes through, if the European Commission does this. I mean, they might have a stipulation to force Oracle to sell off some of the hardware assets. Who knows what they're going to come up with? So they might stall for a much longer period of time. I think they are supposed to come out with something next week, but sometimes they work a bit slower. I mean, this whole acquisition seems like it's been going in slow motion.
This whole thing's a mess, Michael. And the only thing that's for certain is we're going to be talking about it again, if not next week, then soon.
Yep. I agree. Okay. Well, I think that probably should wrap it up for today. I think, we'll be following all these stories over the next months and years ahead. And we'll see if Oracle does find true love with Sun Microsystems, and we'll be back next week and see if that happens.
All right. Thanks a lot, Michael.
All right. Thanks, Addison. Talk to you next week.
You've been listening to HPC Wire Soundbite with Michael Feldman and Addison Snell. Got a question or comment for Michael or Addison? Email soundbite at hpcwire.com. HPC Wire Soundbite is available every Friday afternoon from iTunes or at hpcwire.com. HPC Wire, the leading source for global news and information covering the ecosystem of high productivity computing.